Warning, the following podcast contains spoilers and swears.
Hi, who are you?
Hi, I'm Evelyn Rogers. Who are you?
I'm your father, Scott Rogers. What are we doing here?
Oh, it's a podcast.
What's it called?
It's called Villery and Father, where we talk about the magicians and magicians-related things.
And what magicians-related things are we talking about today?
Today we're talking about Season 3, Episode 5 of The Magicians, A Life in the Day, and we have a very special guest.
Is that director John Scott?
Yes. And we have a very special guest.
That's our guest, is director John Scott.
That's our very special guest, High King Elliot himself, Hale Appelman.
That's me. Hey guys.
All hail High King Elliot. We're bowing right now. We're bowing to our king, the king of Fillory. So yes, thanks. we are honored to be in the presence of the High King of Fillory himself today.
Okay,
Mr. Hale Appelman. Yay. This is where you hear thunderous applause.
Oh, I can hear it. It's been so long. Thank you guys for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here. I really love this family podcast you guys have going on. It's real cute. I like it.
Aww. Thank you.
Aw, we're cute. Aww. So, all right. So we want to ask you before we get into the episode, which is we'll talk about.
I have many.
Yeah, I know you have. this is the one you've been waiting for.
I have one of them.
But I would like to know, because I'm not as Hale obsessed as Evelyn might be.
No.
I'd like to know more about how you got involved with the Magicians TV show.
Yeah.
Well, so I suppose this is way back in 2014. I had moved out to Los Angeles mostly because my feet were cold and I couldn't pay my rent in New York. And I had done a bunch of theater in and around New York City and some independent films. But I really was hungry for a change of scene. And so for a couple years, I really struggled in Los Angeles, auditioning for mostly guest stars on NCIS and CSI and things that wouldn't necessarily inspire me, even if they had been long-term jobs for me. So I had to get really objective about my life and what I wanted out here and why I was even here. And luckily, I had a great group of friends, and I felt like there was a community in Los Angeles that I felt really easily connected to. And so there was a lot that I enjoyed about being out here, but I wasn't quite finding my groove as an actor. And I really got clear about what I wanted. The kind of role that would inspire me, that would feel like it checked a lot of boxes for me. And I remember writing a list of attributes to the character that would feel like a dream role to me at the time. And I essentially described Elliot in a journal that I was keeping.
Can you tell us what some of those attributes were?
Sure. Yeah. So I think probably this is probably a bit of a paraphrase at this point, but it was something like, you know, a mischievous dandy who lives in a fantasy realm, who comes of noble origin, who cracks the wittiest one-liners, who is sexually fluid and proud of his ever-changing identity. It was something like that.
So that sounds perfect for the part of Penny, right? Which is, wasn't that what you first, weren't you first?
Right.
Read for Penny?
That's true. The first role I read for was for Penny, and the way that Penny had been described in the character description was having a quote-unquote Clockwork Orange level attitude. And I felt, as a fan of that film, I felt, you know, well, that's something that I could find my way into. I feel like that felt right. I understood why my agent submitted me for that part. And I remember sitting across from Carrie Audino in the audition, and she gave me a bit of a funny look, and I could tell that I wasn't right for it. And the way that it was written didn't feel it didn't really feel as advertised. There was something else going on with the character that just wasn't quite aligned with me. So I pretty quickly knew that I wasn't the guy for that part. And a friend of mine said, you know, you should really read the novels. The Magicians is a great book series. And he passed them to me. And so I really fell in love with Elliot quickly and prayed to the gods to deliver me an audition for that character. And I was just crossing my fingers that Carrie had seen a seed of me in the character of Elliot and would think to remember to bring me back for that role. And sure enough, a couple weeks later, she did. Also, fun fact, on the porch that I was writing in that journal was also a double ram's head planter with some succulents growing out of it. So, it felt kind of like all signs were pointing to this upon, you know, 2020 hindsight. I can see clearly that it was, there is an aspect of it that feels like I was meant to play that part for whatever reason. I'm so proud to have had the opportunity and to have grown along with the show and the character. And the greatest gift of the last 6 years and of being on the show has seen how Elliot has been a beacon for certain queer or trans, gay, LGBTQ, IA plus kids out there, even adults, to see firsthand the impact that the character has had in terms of representation in a genre that was really lacking has been probably the most rewarding aspect of getting to play him, you know, and there have been a lot of really great moments, but it means a lot to me to see that there has been, a purpose behind it all that goes a little bit further than just my own, you know, vain actor ego and the fun and the joy of playing the character, which is great for me, but to actually see, you know, what the ripple effect looks like and who's been impacted means a lot.
So I find it interesting that you read the book, you know, in between applying for the role applying for the job of, you know, being this person. Because I'm a relatively new finisher of the books. I
forced him to read them.
Right. I finished the books just a few weeks ago. And I feel that obviously, as you know, all the characters have undergone some sort of change, you know, to accommodate being on television.
Yeah.
But when I finished reading the books, I turned to Evelyn and I said, I feel like your portrayal of Elliot was the most true to the version in the book. And I also said that when I was reading the books, now granted, this is a byproduct of watching the show, but your voice was the only one I really heard when I'd read the character, I heard your voice. And so I think that you did a wonderful job embodying Elliot so much, because I do feel like, you know, and obviously the credit goes also to the writers and the directors and et cetera.
And Lev,
I guess. I think that, I mean, this is my opinion, but out of all the characters, I feel that your portrayal is the truest to the book version as well.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it was, I felt the need to try and capture him as closely as I possibly could based on having read the books. And I would say also having the source material during my audition really gave me an inside view into who Elliot was and his psychology, how he thought. And the cadence of his speech was something that I think the books also really helped me deliver.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I, you know, Lev is a complete genius, and I bow to him, and I'm a huge fan. And so I felt like there was something really special and unique that needed to be preserved about the voice of this character and how Lev had crafted him. So that means a lot to me. Thank you.
Yeah. So let me ask you though, we're now, keep in mind, we're only still in season three.
Yes. And also I should say my dad hasn't seen season five.
So no spoilers, even though this is a spoiler podcast.
Spoilers up into like season four, episode 13. But finale, you know,
is there something about Elliot that maybe you created in your, you know, your headcanon as you were portraying the character, yeah, that we never got to learn about or experience about Elliot and his backstory, or maybe even some adventure he had in between that we never got to see in that time?
Tell us those beats, those objectives.
Are you asking if there were moments on the show that weren't previously written in the books? Is that the question?
That's part of it.
More
but...
like the internal work.
Right.
Like, yeah, those internal motivations. And
oh, okay.
Kind of,
well,
you know, what's that secret that you got in every scene?
Yeah.
You
know,
take it back to acting one.
Okay. well, I immediately grabbed biographies of David Bowie and Oscar Wilde, which were my primary sources of men who I felt broke the shackles of their time in terms of identity and expression and were able to invent their own persona to provide a canvas for their art. Right? I mean, Oscar Wilde was a larger than life character, David Bowie
absolutely,
similarly, and Oscar's words and witticisms are eternal. Bowie's music will live forever. But the way that they presented themselves as these, you know, witty dandies in their own right, you know, Bowie obviously as a glam rocker and a ever-changing evolution, his many guises over the course of his career, you know, was essentially like the invention of the modern pop star in so many ways, rock star, pop star, whatever. And so I really feel like Elliot had this agency within him to create his own image and reinvent it day to day based on how he felt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my primary collaborator on that front was Magali, our costume designer, who's a brilliant genius.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she and I discussed at length each look, every article of clothing, like why he would wear something, and would track Elliot's emotional journey, particularly over the course of the first season, with every outfit that he wore as a reflection of his psychology in that moment, or his emotional state, or a reflection of, or a comment on the theme of the episode and his take on it. There was something almost meta about the way that Elliot approached presenting himself to the public and to the world. It's almost, there were moments where I felt like, particularly on the show as the show progressed, that I felt like Elliot has a sneaking suspicion that he might be on a TV show. Like, there were just moments in the way that the show broke so many rules that at some moments I felt like, you know.
He knew. Yeah,
he had this kind of omniscient point of view at times that was surprising and pretty deep and wise for someone who, in other ways, was kind of childish and a bit guarded.
Mm-hmm. Right. Was there one outfit in particular that you especially loved wearing?
Oh my God, so many! It's really hard to whittle that down to just one.
What season was your favorite clothing?
Pick a season three one. There we go.
I think season three's clothes were probably the height of the fantasy for Elliot, for sure.
We're big fans of the blue sailing coat you had.
Oh yeah, that was pretty fantastic. Magali was very excited about it. It was great. It was this kind of embossed velvet velour kind of thing that had this very specific texture that was really lovely. There was a vest, pants, and a huge flowing overcoat that really caught the wind, and it was pretty great. That was also That might be the most beautiful location we ever shot as well. Yeah, that episode where we docked the boat there.
Yeah, the shots from that episode are gorgeous.
Yeah.
What about there was a very specific purple shirt that you wore. Do you have any memories of that one?
Jeez Louise, he's worn so much purple.
I have no idea what you're talking about. A purple shirt. A purple shirt.
What episode is that purple shirt from?
Season two?
It's season two.
With the red suit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the...
My friend has that.
And the neck wrap. Oh, they have the shirt. Oh, that's
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, they got the shirt. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That suit was incredible, for sure. And the way that Mogali draped the fabric and on the form really gave it an impressive... I remember that jacket particularly had a really impressive kind of like ruffled breast or something. It was really beautiful.
Yeah, we really have been enjoying the costume design. Your clothing, of course, is gorgeous. Margot's costuming is amazing. Yeah. You know, so many great work there. You know, and that's such an unsung art, right? Is that costume design? And I particularly love hearing how much you worked with the costume designer to think about what the costume motivation was. That's you never get to hear a lot about that. So shout out to the costume
designer. Mogali was my lifeline through. I mean, the series, and I would say outside of, you know, Summer and obviously the showrunners, I would say Mogali was my closest collaborator. Mm-hmm. She had a sense of who Elliot was as soon as she met me, and we developed his sense of style together. She exceeded all expectations with her design, but she also was generous enough to let me collaborate with her and give her my two cents on, you know, more of the basic side of things, like, you know, like which combinations I wanted, what I felt worked best, or which tie with which shirt. Like, that was a very open collaboration.
Did they do the lightsaber thing where, you know, they gave Ewan McGregor a choice of five different lightsabers? Was that you with your ties?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, they were all very specifically curated by Mogali, so she gets all the credit. And I would say probably, like, you know, 40% of my performance is certainly indebted to her.
I thought you were going to say 40% of the performance was selecting the right tie.
I mean, in some way it does help, you know. It really, when you slip on the right pair of shoes or the right coat and you're playing a character and you wake up not really feeling like him, it does really transform you, you know. Elliot also had many different particular hairstyles and certain makeup palettes and makeup schemes that we, you know, we had, I think we had three or four different makeup designers over the course of the show. And they each brought something different and helped me facilitate the specificity of extravagance that he wanted to express on any given day. Yeah. Right. So these elements are necessary to create a character like that whose persona is connected to the hair, makeup, and wardrobe in such a specific way.
I have some specific makeup questions for you later, but my other big question is, was there anything on the show? I mean, you can be vague so not to spoil anything, but was there anything on the show that you got to do either acting wise or like, you know, I got to fence or I got to ride a horse or I got to, you know, whatever it was that you got to do that was kind of like a dream thing for you to do with this role?
Yes, for sure. I was begging the showrunners to let me swashbuckle from season one. And so season two, episode 9, I believe, was the duel.
Right. Yeah, the
with
big
the
fight.
Rival king. Yeah.
Yeah.
Shout out to Leonard Roberts, who's an incredible actor.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, I wish that Elliot and King Idri had more story together, because I think we had a lot of fun working together, and it just felt like an immediate, easy rapport that we had. And that episode particularly was a great joy. And, you know, I really, you know, on TV, the shooting schedule is famously quick, so there's not a lot of prep time, you know. So I had arranged for, I think, probably like two or three training sessions which, you know, people kind of just assume that, you know, you learn the choreography and you show up and you do it. But I mean, I think there were three different sequences that we had to learn, and, you know, they were, I think, like four hour training sessions, which is still pretty quick when you consider you know, you have like three or four takes to get it right in a couple different setups. And of course there were stunt doubles for some of the wider shots, but
you had to learn how to jump into a tree.
That was really awesome. And I really did learn how to do a like forward roll over my sword and stand up, you know, on the other side of it. So there were some like pretty specific stunts that I was actually doing myself.
That's fucking impressive, man.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that was, you know,
someone who's tried to forward roll before and failed with a sword.
Yeah, I kind of felt like that episode was my, you know, Monty Python, Princess Bride, Robin Hood, Men in Tights fantasy come to life, right? You know, so, and they added the Les Mis song at the 11th hour, I think like a week before we shot. John McNamara turned to me and said, "Oh, by the way, you'll be singing this song as you march into battle." And I kind of nodded and smiled and just went with it. You know, I mean, I didn't understand at the in the moment really like what they were going for with that. But I think in retrospect, I hope it feels appropriately campy to me. Like, it was a campy choice to put that song in there at all. And I love the shot of Idris Army kind of standing there puzzled, looking at us quizzically as we're, you know, belting the end of the song.
No, it's a pretty great episode. All right, so I have one more question about production before we dive in.
Hop on into it.
To the episode, and that is, how was the craft service food?
Oh my god, Dad.
you don't have to answer it if it's not a.
We had overall, I would say we had the greatest crew of all time. I think the craft service food was fine. It was definitely, it was definitely within a certain budget, but we
it
enjoyed
was typical
it.
Craft service it. Food is what you're saying.
Yeah. Sometimes it depended on the day, but, there were certain basics that we could always count on, which were
all good. Right. I just always have to ask, cause I'm always curious. There's such varying levels of craft service in the television and film industries. So, all right. Well, shall we? Well, I didn't ask him what the sloth smelled like, so it's okay. God. What did the sloth smell like?
No.
All right. Her name was Sassy. I think she passed away, actually.
She did.
She had,
we had Sergio on not too long ago.
Actually, for, 209.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She had a busy film schedule, and I think she was a little Judy Garland. I think they worked her too hard.
Oh, no.
Rest in peace, Sassy.
Oh my goodness.
All right, so shall we get into the episode?
Speaking of
yeah,
death and dying and
no, there's a pretty light in this episode.
Characters die in this.
Well, yeah, I know, but it's a happy death. Compared to most of the other deaths.
Yeah, that's true.
Only one bad death in the whole episode.
Yeah.
Right? All right, so shall we?
Yeah.
let's do it.
Yeah. So, woohoo, Life in the Day. We've been waiting for this one. Well, the episode opens at the cottage. It's Quentin and Alice, and we get this very awkward conversation between them. They don't really know where they stand with each other anymore as, like, a kind of relationship or in a relationship and then like as friends. And Alice says, you know, like, I'm sorry, it's weird now. I'm sorry. It's just weird. It's weird now. And so they try to kind of talk, but nothing really comes of it. And then she takes Penny and leaves.
So Hale, during these shots, when they would do, you know, Jason and all the other actors, were you chilling in your,
No, he's working in the background. He's researching.
Oh, is he? Was he in that shot?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. What would you do to kind of like keep yourself occupied during a shot like this when you weren't the center of attention?
Well, you know, I would probably only be featured in a wide shot. I don't remember, God. I don't remember specifically that scene. Are Jason?
You don't remember
and I
sitting at a table looking at a book,
looking at piles of books.
I remember sitting at a table with Jason and having a scene with him at the table.
Yeah. Yes,
I remember that scene.
That's in a bit. That's don't worry.
A little later on.
We're starting with the scene that I can't even remember. Oh, God.
that's okay.
It's okay.
If you can't remember, you just say pass.
You just listen to me.
To be honest with you, those scenes were always fun because the pressure was off. And so if I had to float in the background of the scene as a glorified extra or whatever, or like Elliot, you know, looking for a book in the background, then that was just fun business for me to do as an actor that helped me.
Did you prefer doing the fun business, or did you prefer being like Elliot in a coma?
Elliot in a coma was fun because I could just I could just close my eyes and sleep. I think that Elliot in a coma episodes, there were a couple of them, but that's always fun because you get to, you know, everyone else is like screaming and crying around you and you're just like lying on a gurney taking a nap. So
just hanging out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We always, whenever we see an episode like that, we go, oh, that was an easy day for Hale, or that was an easy day for Arjun or whoever, you know, there's a lot of those where you guys are like, you know, dead or incapacitated in some way.
Yeah. Definitely like a nice break, particularly when the schedules were really intense, which they often were. So, you know, some days it was 12 to 17 hours, you know, and episodes that you're prominently featured, you're usually in 3 or 4 days in a row. So that's a really specific work-life balance, if you could call it that, you know?
Yeah. It's all work, no balance.
Yeah.
All right. So what comes out of this conversation?
Well, Alice goes to Katie at the Crick Memorial Hospital, and Katie's kind of just...
Wait a second. Who is Crick? Is that an in-joke?
It's just the name.
Are you sure? Is it not like one of the writer's moms or something?
Crick?
I don't know. It's memorializing somebody named Crick.
Okay.
I didn't know.
I wouldn't know the answer to this one, but I'm sure you could come up with some theories.
A random stab in the dark.
Right.
There.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be deliberate. Somebody actually went in and like photoshopped in the name.
Probably. But we see Katie and Alice, and Alice has come to visit her, and she's brought the truth key with her. And she's like, okay, just trust me on this. Like, take this key. This is a great plan, guys.
It's a bad plan.
It's an awful plan. So Katie takes the truth key and sees Penny.
Yay.
Surprise. Spooky ghost Penny.
Penny who, by the way, that was a great, I think that was the best cliffhanger in the whole series so far, was when Elliot saw Penny.
Like, oh, so yeah. Good.
That was such a funny moment in the show.
It's a great episode.
It is a great episode. All right, but here we are in the other great episode.
Yes. Well, Katie sees Penny and then immediately proceeds to like yell at him. Alice leaves them alone, which is, again, a bad idea because Katie's currently like at a hospital, you know, being rehabilitated. And that probably doesn't put a great case for her mental health if she's yelling at nothing. And, you know, Penny's like, hey, you know, at least I'm not stuck in the underworld. And she's like, well, you know, I saved you and I failed and that broke me. So now why are you here? And Penny says, well, it's to help you. It's the reason I'm here. And Katie says, no, I have to put myself back together. And if you say you love me, I'll find another way to kill you. So she's really mad at him. So she like throws the key to the ground and runs out of the place.
Right.
Again. And then, bad plan on Alice's part.
Right. And then Alice comes back and says,
she picks up the key and Penny's like, remind me to never listen to your advice ever again.
Yes. Yeah. Bad advice, Alice. Sorry.
Yeah.
So then we get
Elliot and Quentin.
Elliot scene. Yay.
They're researching. They're looking through stacks and stacks of books. Elliot has sent Fenn and Frey with Todd to New York City.
Now, wait a second. I want to know, where's that episode? Where is the Fenn and Todd and Frey episode? Because what do you think happens?
Well, they say it in the next one.
They say what?
They talk a little bit about
it. We don't get to see them like singing New York, New York.
No, we don't get to see them wandering around.
Oh, man. That would have been it. See, that's another good spinoff show. Mm. That's something that happens on our podcast, Hale, is we come up with spinoff shows for you guys to help
your careers.
So far some of our better ones were you and Quentin and Alice and was it Was it Penny as Ghostbusters in England? So kind of like that one episode where you guys were following the ghosts around. And what's another one of our good spinoff stories?
There's so many good ones.
Yes. Did we have any more Hale-centric spinoff stories?
No,
it was the pirate one, remember? Oh, yeah. We had a whole show that was you guys having pirate adventures. Yeah.
Oh yeah. That ship was pretty amazing, I have to say.
So what was the Mudjack, the Mudjack, the thing on the front, what was that made out of? No, I know what it was supposed to be, but what was it made out of?
I think it was made of a kind of semi-soft foam.
Yeah.
You know, and the coating of paint over it gave it kind of a slightly harder exterior, but I don't actually know. I believe it's some kind of like medium ply foam type material.
Like a latex or something? Or?
Not latex. Yeah, maybe.
That's more for prosthetics.
Maybe. I don't know. It's like Halloween props are made out of latex,
that's
right?
That's true. That's true.
So,
like
kind
of foam that you could sculpt, I imagine. Right. I don't know. I'm not the person to ask about that.
Did you get that? Were you able to take that boat home with you?
It's a whole boat.
Yeah, I have it in my pocket. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think they sold it. I think we were on set shooting. I don't remember where we were or what episode, but it was season 4 or 5, and the boat had been sold. And the Mudjack was like sailed by, you know, so
it ruined the shot. Like there's the Mudjack.
It's fun to say that it ruined the shot, but I don't know if that's true. Yeah.
Did you get to spend the night on the boat?
No, that never happened. But we did go out, you know, some of those days at sea were really wild and intense because there were camera crews on little barges on either side of the boat getting wider shots. And then, you know, obviously the interior of the boat was on the sound stage because it was a kind of trick of the eye in which the interior has, it's like, you know, it's a whole luxury apartment with a tree growing out of it. But, on the inside of the actual boat, it was really tight quarters. You maybe could fit 3 people down there uncomfortably. Yeah,
surprisingly tiny boat. When I like the boat they describe in the book is much bigger than the one that was used in the show.
All budget.
True. Right. That was a pretty budget heavy episode too. There was special effects and all types of stuff.
Yeah.
I think anything on the water is budget heavy. And I think the boat was a big dent in the budget of season 3 altogether.
So that's why there's only 2 episodes with the boat.
Yeah. I think, it was a big investment. And then the practical usage of it was more complicated from what I understand.
All right.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, so what happens next in the story?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, when's our pirate movie coming, Hale?
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, you and Arjun should do a pirate movie.
Yes.
Oh, that would be good. I would watch that.
Yeah, you could wear the frock coats and Arjun could run around with his shirt off like he likes to do.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that.
We're just making observations based on the TV show. We have no idea whether Arjun likes to wear a shirt or not.
He usually wears shirts.
That's good.
Yeah, he's a good shirt wearer. Good guy.
But we see Elliot and Quentin researching. The next key is in Fillory. There's specifically an illustration of the mosaic.
All right. So I had a question.
Oh, God.
And that is, if there's a illustration of the mosaic when Jane Chatwin found it, right? Yeah, it was Jane. It was a picture of Jane looking at the mosaic.
No, that's not her. That's the daughter of the knight.
That was the daughter of the knight? Yeah. I thought that was Jane.
No.
I didn't specify. I was going to say, why didn't Elliot and Quentin just look at that picture in the book and copy that? And they would have been done. Boom. Nobody had to die.
That's not the key to all life. That's not the beauty of all life.
We'll talk about the rules to this game later on.
It's not a game. It's a quest.
It's a puzzle.
Oh, my God. But it's not a typical
puzzle. If you
were
playing an adventure game, the mosaic would be a puzzle.
Well, it's not an adventure game. Well, it's a TV show.
Maybe it's in the game that you could put it in the game that you're making.
No.
Did you know that Evelyn is making a magician's unauthorized video game?
Ooh, no, I didn't. But I bet it'll be incredibly artful.
It is. It's already quite beautiful.
Thank you. But no, they have to find the beauty of life. They have to use the tiles to reflect the beauty of all life. And at the end, it was said in the book that you got a key to greater magic. And in this case, you know, the metaphors are literal, as Elliot says.
Right.
So they are planning to go and solve the mosaic. They got to get to Fillory first, which right now they don't have magic. So it's a little complicated.
This is the easiest way for them to have gotten to Fillory, though. This is like what it is in the book, right?
Sort of.
What do you mean sort of? That's how they...
Yes, that's why they go through the clock. Because it's classic Fillory imagery, Narnia imagery.
But I thought Fillory was you could never get to Fillory the same way twice.
Yeah, but they haven't gone through the clock yet.
I thought they went through the clock in the other one.
Season two.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe is it just once a season?
Yeah.
Did they, Hale, when they were writing the scripts and stuff, did the writers have like a pretty complex set of rules to how magic worked in the show?
Yes. So I think that they had different rules for different worlds. I believe they tried to implement the rules that Lev set up in the novel. Of course, they took some liberties episode to episode, depending on the quest or the storyline. And they also invented a few worlds that I think didn't exist in the books as well, depending on the episode as well. So Sarah is really good at world building and at kind of curating and keeping tabs on all of the varying rules, you know, per world, per character, whatever it might be. So she has a running map of all of this stuff in her head at all times. And so I think someone without that skill would have been in way over their heads to run a show like this one.
Yeah, there's a lot to keep track of, right? Yeah. With all the worlds and the realities and the time loops and all that.
Circumstances.
Yeah. Because the show had to add material that wasn't in the books, was there ever a moment where the writers came to you actors and said, hey, is there any sort of relationship you would like to explore with your character?
No, that never happened. It was pretty much as, you know, and they break the season when they get into the writer's room and map out essentially where they want to start and where they want to end up. And then they spend their time in the writer's room developing each of those episodes. But they have a rough idea of, I think, where they want the season to go and what the arc of each character would be for those 13 episodes.
All right. I have one more writer related question that I have no idea if you have any insight to or not.
Oh my goodness.
Why wasn't there more Bingle?
Oh, that's a good question. We loved Bingle. He was very talented and a lovely person to have on set. So I couldn't tell you. It also felt like a character from the books that could have been built into, like, kind of much in the same way that Fenn was. So yeah. I don't really know. I don't have an answer for that.
Bingle is another one of our spinoffs. the Adventures of Bingle.
But then we see Tick and Margo. Tick is scraped off, you know, a brick from the hallway where the fairies can't talk. And it took him 7 hours, but he got a little jar. But Margo says, go and scrape for 7 more hours because we got to put this in her bathtub and poison her. Yes. But before they can get any further with that plan, the fairy queen shows up. Shout out to Candace Kane. What a woman. And it turns out that she's arranged for Margo to get married, to have a wedding, political wedding.
Did they, on set, sometimes you hear stories of the characters that are playing like the bad guys are separated from the leads. So that way you build like a little false animosity. Did they do that with the Fairy Queen with you guys?
No. No, nothing remotely approaching any kind of method psychology around keeping us separate or together or anything like that. No
Kubrickian methoding.
No.
Manipulating of the actors.
Yeah. No. And Candace Kane is someone who I used to go see perform live in New York at gay clubs with my godfather when I was like 14. So I remember seeing Candace when I was a kid and she sauntered up to my table at one point and said, you guys, who the fuck let Harry Potter into my show? And so when she was sitting on set, I reminded her and she remembered, and we had this kind of sweet reunion. I didn't really know her that well, but I met her a few times back in the day. So it was kind of this really beautiful full circle moment that she was on the show.
That's awesome.
Oh, that's wonderful. But yeah, Margot's getting married to one of the people of the Floating Mountain Tribe, which is no longer floating because Magic died.
Fell in the sea.
Yep. But she asks the Fairy Queen, why do I have to do this? And the Fairy Queen says, because, you know, the floaters have 4,000 spears and they will, you know, increase your army. And being a queen means sacrificing for your people. And this is what Margot has to do. And we do actually see this kind of methodology reflected later in what the Fairy Queen actually does at the end of the season, which is pretty cool to think about.
So is it fair to say, Hale, that really Margot was running Fillory?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You won't find any resistance there from me.
Gotcha. Yeah.
No, she's high king.
She holds it down. She holds it down. Yeah, I think season three, she really came into her power, and I think Summer really ran with it and did a beautiful job.
Yeah, Summer is amazing. In this season in particular, we're still keeping our fingers crossed that we could maybe get her to come and talk to us, because there's so many questions, particularly about, there's these moments of emotion that she just kind of brings up that are amazing. And we just want to know, like, you know, what were you thinking of during that moment to get that such an amazing reaction on screen?
Dead puppies.
Yeah, exactly. Is it all dead puppies? Or
she's one of the most committed and idiosyncratic people I've ever met, and I don't know if she knows how she works, because there's something so intuitive about her ease on set and her ability to tap into the deepest, most complex emotions. So I have nothing but real massive respect for Summer. And I knew that as a team, she and I brought different qualities to the table. And that's part of what was strong about showcasing us together.
Yeah, it's amazing charisma on screen.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But then we see Prince S. He's back for the wedding. And we get this kind of flirty repartee between them, where you know, they're kind of threatening each other and kind of flirting with each other, but, you know, obviously Margot is you know, she's like, you're not even in my top 50, baby. She's dominating the whole time, and it is great. But we hear from Tick that the fairies have actually the floaters have set up camp in the fairy repellent hallway, so now there's no place for them to talk.
How big is that hallway?
Really, it's just the only hallway in the castle.
It's just Castle Whitespire is the throne room, one hallway, and a foyer, maybe, and a dungeon. A lot of people get tossed in the dungeon.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they redressed that hallway like 17 different ways, to try and keep it fresh. Right. But yeah. You guys caught on.
<It's good>. Yeah. Magic of Hollywood, baby.
Yeah.
But then we see Elliot and Quentin again, and they're staring at the Fillory clock. And they're trying to decide whether to go in, but there's no actual keyhole. And they're like, well, we need to, you know, figure out how we're going to get this quest to work. And then some bunnies show up saying, at castle, getting married. Need help, dickwads. So they're like, oh, plot development. Let's go fucking help Margot. And that's when the keyhole appears.
Right.
And you see this wonderful shot of the key going inside the keyhole. And it turns, and there's this beautiful bright light, and they step inside.
And then they are transported magically to Fillory.
Yes. And my mom pointed out that the clock starts running backwards.
Oh, I didn't see that.
So, you know, all the little details. But they step out, and the portal closes, and they're in Fillory. They're in the forest, and they can feel like the magic in the air.
And the magic is represented by giant spotlights.
Giant floodlights in the background.
Good eye. Yeah.
And you get to see you guys, like, hugging, and, you know, this is, like, the very first time we see them happy, really.
This might be the happiest episode in the whole show.
Yeah.
Yeah, we definitely took note of that ourselves, I think, when we were shooting that moment, too.
Who doesn't like being in Fillory with the LSD-laced air?
Oh, yeah.
Good Lord. But they spot Castle Whitespire in the difference, and the North Tower is still being constructed.
So they're in the past.
They're in the past. Dun, dun, dun.
Plot twist. Now, did they know how far in the past they are? Were they able to go, oh, this is only like 15 years in the past?
It's more than that.
Oh.
Because...
like 17 years? No.
It's more than that, because when Quentin is in like in his 70s is when Jane shows up, and that's in the 40s.
Oh, okay. So you guys showed up. You guys were actually... how long did they live for?
50 years.
Only 50 years?
Well, they were there for 50
So then that means
years.
That if it was the 1940s, so that means that if Elliot and Quentin had gone back through the clock again, it would be the 1880s?
No.
Isn't that how it would work?
What do you think?
I don't know. What do you think, Hale?
I'm not the person to ask about that.
You didn't figure out the chronology of where you were at when you were acting the scene? I'm being sarcastic.
I mean, I'm sure I did at the time, but now, you know, 3 years later or however long, I mean, maybe more than that, 3 years, 4 years.
Well, I mean, according to time, you traveled all the way back to the 1880s. So
That's right. I should have a handle on this. Yeah, no, I had no idea.
You're actually 137 years old and
you look great.
Yeah, you look great for your age.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah. Sunscreen, you know.
They walk up to the mosaic where there's a man trying to solve it. And Quentin explains that when Jane came up to the mosaic, someone had already solved it. So presumably Quentin and Elliot are the ones who solved the mosaic.
Right.
And that, you know, they've got to do it.
My money's on Elliot.
Well, so in one way he does. But we see a guy, he's like, here, go ahead and do it yourselves. It's a waste of your time. And Quentin... So, tallies up the tiles. There's 784 tiles in 15 colors, which is like infinity.
So hang on a second. First of all, my question to you, Hale, is, was this shot in Vancouver or was this on a soundstage?
Oh, no, it was in Vancouver. It was in a park. And, you know, it was the fun of it, I think, for Jason and I was that the setups, particularly for the mosaic sequence, were largely... almost felt like being on stage, almost like a proscenium, in the sense that there were a lot of wider shots and the set didn't change. So we felt like there was a lot that we could do, I guess, with actors with kind of a stage background to not only implement all of the little moments in the script, which sadly, all of them didn't make it into the edit sometimes, you know, because the show was on a commercial break structure. The timing of each episode needed to be exact. And I think it's like 43 minutes or something like that. But there was also a lot of improvisation and little moments of domesticity that Jason and I found that I think were really nuanced and gave made their way into the episode in little moments here or there, but there was a lot more that I think we were able to find just because the setup was the same and we weren't running around the forest, you know, trying to catch light on those days. We had a lot to do, but we knew where we were going to be, and John Scott set up the shots in such a way that allowed us some freedom to really explore and play and find those moments for ourselves.
Was there one moment or shot in particular that you wish that had been left in?
To be honest with you, there were whole scenes that were cut when we were wandering through the woods that I wish
had
to cut. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was a little side plot with, you know, Quentin falls in love with the woman who ends up becoming his wife and the mother of our child. And also... Lunk, you know, the hunky dude, yeah. Lunk. Elliot and Lunk have like a little bit of a fling as well that didn't make the cut.
What? We missed out on more Lunk.
You missed out on more Lunk. Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe in some ways, maybe it might be for the best. I don't know. I could see it. I could see how it would work either way.
So really what you're saying is we as fans should demand the Scott cut of this episode.
I think the Scott cut was a very long version. I remember hearing through the grapevine that originally his cut was like an hour and a half or something like that.
Wow.
Hey, you know.
So there was a lot of material. There was a lot.
Too bad that didn't get onto the DVD.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question. How come when you get up to this mosaic and it's a whole bunch of tiles, why didn't you guys just try to replicate like Super Mario World World 1-1 or something? Like, because essentially it's just pixels.
Not the beauty of all life, though.
The meaning of all life, World 1-1. Is there a better level in video games than Super Mario World?
I don't think it's Mario.
You don't think so?
No.
No? Were there any gags like that where you guys were like drawing Mega Man out of pixels or something?
No, but I think there were a selection of like pixelated images that they set up and got from, I can't remember if it actually made it into the episode, but there might have been a little sizzle reel of all of the different bird's eye like attempts that they made to solve it, which were, you know, a boat, a flower, you know, whatever it might be.
Right. Yeah. Usually I find when you give any person control of the pixels, like if it's a game editor or something, usually they just draw a penis.
You know?
Yeah.
It could be.
I mean, that is the source of all life, right?
Some of it.
I mean, what one might argue that the female anatomy is the actual source of all
that's
life.
True. All right. Fair enough.
Uh-huh.
I'm getting a look from Evelyn. not a happy look. All right. So let's move on from that topic.
Anyway, I'm gonna.
But then we see Margo and Lady Agate Gray, the Stone Queen. She has a mutual friend, very pale friend. Fairy Queen. And she's like, well, we're here for you to wed my son. Here, you want to just forego tradition and I can introduce you to him. And she brings out Prince Fomar first, this little 15-year-old snot-nosed brat, dude. Awful man, awful little boy. Just disgusting little Weasley boy.
Well, we learn he's more of a weasel.
He was also a fantastic actor. That boy was fantastic.
That's good. Know.
Yeah, we assume that even the worst characters on this show are actually lovely people.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But then we get to see Margot's wonderful, handsome husband-to-be, Micah.
Yes.
And his name means shiny and easily broken. So
there you go.
For all you rock fans out there.
That's a rock joke.
A rock joke? It's a rock fact.
Well, okay. But it's also a joke, right?
Yes, because later on.
Yes, we see what happens to Micah.
Yes. But then we see Margo and Micah have a little talk, and she asks him about like what he thinks about women. And she learns that the floaters live in a matriarchal society.
And Margo is okay with that.
She is very down to clown with Micah. She's ready to go.
All right.
And then we see her getting all dolled up for her wedding, and they're getting ready in like the same room, but you know, they've got little shielders for modesty, and a mysterious assassin comes in through the window and tries to shoot at Micah.
Yes. I noticed that I was glad to see that the makeup artist remembered to draw Margot's tattoo on her back.
Continuity.
Did you, Hale, did you ever have to go through that and show off your tattoo?
Elliot didn't get one.
Tattoo.
Elliot didn't get one. I think he got one in the books, but not.
Yeah, he did.
Not in the show. Yeah. I was upset. I thought an Elliot Kako demon would have been pretty hilarious.
Yeah, it would have been pretty awesome.
But I'm very grateful I never had to, you know, go through the extra, whatever, 45 minutes tattoo procedure, you know.
And I understand those tattoos were real, right?
No. That's...
yep, fully real.
Margo goes and confronts S about the assassination attempt. She thinks that he did it, and he was like, why would I do that? I'm here to like support you because of our, you know, Idri and Elliot's alliance. And she's like, well, you were mad about not getting in my pants, so guards, take him to the dungeon.
Throw him in the extra large dungeon.
The extra large dungeon. And yeah, so it looks like the wedding's gonna go on with only a slight hitch.
Well, no, everybody's gonna live happily ever after, right?
Yeah, totally. It's, nothing bad ever happens on The Magicians.
Exactly. It's just one happy thing after another.
But then we see Quentin and Elliot. This is the moment. They're trying to, again, solve the mosaic, and magic doesn't work on it. And Q gets very frustrated, and Elliot says, you know, well, this is our quest. We have to do it ourselves. Someone solved it, so we're the ones that have to solve it. And, you know, Quentin's like, I didn't think it would take a decade. And it's just like, oh, man, it's really setting in. They're in for the long haul.
Right. They're right. It's going to take a while.
Yeah. It's going to take a while. But then we see Alice and Julia.
Wait a second. I have a question for Hale, because we haven't asked Hale a question in like 10 seconds. Hale, how many times did you guys have to like restack those tiles, like reset them into, you know, I mean, I assume you didn't do it. I assume somebody else did it, but.
Oh, the incredible props department was really on top of all that stuff. Yeah, we had it really easy. We had a lot of great, heads of departments on our show. So that was never really, you know, there's certain things as an actor you have to keep in mind about, you know, which hand you use to pick up the glass so that the edit doesn't skip. But for the most part, a lot of that work was taken care of for us based on the incredible just specificity that all of the creative departments worked with.
How many days did it take to film all? Like, I mean, it's really those scenes are kind of a short montage. But how many days did it take for you to shoot all those scenes?
You know, I think we had 3 days at the Mosaic.
So they were flying.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I mean, in general on the show, there was no, you know, and particularly shooting out your storyline requires you to come in for the most part and be available the entire day. So, if it's a heavy episode for your character, at least how it worked on our show is that you would come in probably 4 or 5 in the morning, go into hair and makeup, and then work until, you know, anywhere between 8 p.m. to midnight, sometimes later on really crazy shoots. But yeah, and then, you know, you're in every scene. So, you know, you wrap one scene and you rehearse the next one, the next moment. It's a really fast moving train is what I'm trying to say.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like a pretty grueling schedule.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I also enjoyed it. And, you know, part of the beauty of the show is being able to walk into all of these fantastical settings that had been already designed for you to just kind of show up and do your thing. So every day kind of felt like walking into a different fantasy world. And that was, you know, this whole show is a real, you know, kind of childhood dream for me. It really felt like it satisfied a vision that maybe, you know, 10-year-old Hale might have had. And, you know, I know that he's happy having had this gig. So
what was there
shout
one?
Out to him.
Yay, 10-year-old
Hale.
Baby Hale. what was there one set in particular that like blew you away more than any other?
To be honest with you, they all did. The library, the classroom, the physical kids cottage, the boat, even the penthouse was exciting, you know, in a different way. The most realistic of all of them, I would say.
Right.
But the boat was really special, I think, and so was the physical kids cottage for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that must have been a fun set.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Speaking of the physical kids cottage, we're there in the next scene. Wow, my transitions are amazing.
Hey.
and we see Alice and Julia, and Julia has been studying religious texts to try and figure out what's been going on with all these people getting possessed in front of her. And who gets possessed but Alice. And
her eyeballs get all white.
Yep. And the other person speaks through her and says, Alice needs your help. And so Julia says, well, let's go get a drink. and then it's wedding time. Margot looks gorgeous. This is like one of my favorite outfits that Mowgli did. It's so like beautiful and chef's kiss all the way through. We got this wonderful wedding ceremony. There's a wedding arch and stuff, and Tick's ready to officiate, and Micah.
Why is Tick officiating?
because he's like the royal advisor. He's like the head guy.
But wouldn't there be like a shaman of Umber or Ember or somebody that would be?
Just Tick.
But that's, I mean, Just Tick is a bunch of reasons. Just
Tick. He's certified in everything.
All right.
But it's time for that hand fasting ceremony. But Margo says, I do. But and after Micah says, I do, what comes out but a
spring-loaded axe.
Spring-loaded axe.
And very cleanly chops his head off.
Yeah, and there's splurts of blood everywhere. And
it's Margo very horrible.
Horribly traumatized.
And out comes the new...
Well, out comes Fomar.
Right, and he says...
He's like, well, as per tradition, the sibling takes the place of the late husband.
Yeah, who came up with that rule?
Ugh. Considering it's a matriarchal society.
Yeah, wouldn't Fillory get dominion over what the rules are for the, like, you know, if your husband's head cut off? Because it's floating. Yeah, it's floating. Fillory. Floating rock people are the ones, you know, it's kind of like when you marry into the Jewish faith, right? Often, like, the people who are not of the Jewish faith will do the ceremony to respect that tradition, right? Mm-hmm. So wouldn't the rock people respect the Fillory tradition?
I guess not. Not Fomar.
Well, not Fomar. Fomar is a jerk. He has no respect for any religion or tradition.
But the fairy queen shows up in the background. She says, Margo, do it. You have to marry him.
So wait, was this manipulation by the fairy queen?
Yeah.
You think she planned this whole thing?
Yeah.
To chop off the head of...
Well, she didn't do it, but...
What happened if the arrow had worked?
Then he would have been dead, and then it would have been Fomar.
What if the axe didn't work?
Then they would have gotten married, and Fomar would probably have poisoned him or something.
Something. That's kind of what I thought was going to happen. I thought they were going to cheer, like have a drink, and then he was going to drop dead from being poisoned or something.
Well, he certainly dropped dead.
Hale, if you were going to murder one of your rivals in Fillory, how would you do it?
I don't know. Maybe like a blow dart.
Blow dart.
No,
good.
I don't know. I'm just making it up. I don't know.
Improv.
To be honest, probably a spell. I would think, you know, probably Elliot would throw a fireball or some.
Oh yeah,
magic. I wish that I had, that's one thing that, you know, the kid in me wished that Elliot had a bit more offensive magic over the course of the series. In season one, there was some lighting shit on fire, but I wish that there had been some more, you know.
You wanted more pyrotechnics.
Yeah.
I just think that if Elliot was pushed far enough, he would be a pretty aggressive opponent, probably.
Well, Elliot did kill his own boyfriend, so
that was true. Self-defense.
That's true.
Yeah. All right, that's a good question. Was that self-defense or was that intentional?
It was.
Evelyn thinks it was self-defense.
It is intentional.
I thought it was intentional.
It is self-defense can be intentional.
Well, yeah,
that's the whole point.
But
of
Elliot knew that he had to kill his boyfriend. All right, let's have Hale settle it. Hale, you were the one who killed the person. Was it intentionally done or self-defense?
Well, I mean, wasn't he putting everyone at risk in that moment?
Right.
Yeah, he was. Possessed.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So I think it was. I think it was an act of self-defense.
Take Evelyn's side. All right, I understand how this works.
Thank you.
It was also a very conflicted moment, obviously.
Yeah. That's true. He had to act quickly.
Yeah. So the poor emotional fallout from that.
Yes.
Oh boy.
Oh boy.
But is it fun to play that kind of torment?
It was a pretty important moment for me on the show that I think helped ground some of Elliot's more whimsical aspects.
Right.
And I would say also that shooting that moment was really intense. Jesse, who played
Mike,
right. Jesse was amazing. And they also, again, you know, the show, Ellie, our DP, is such a genius, and he would frequently provide a more cinematic angle or lens for certain shots. And there was a Hitchcock lens on me for a version of that moment that I don't think they ended up using, but I think it would have been really cool. And I think there's like a super edit of The Magician somewhere that has all of these incredible aspects that no one really got to see, simply because I think probably the taste of the network was a bit more on the nose than some of the vision that
It sounds like the camera crew and the director or directing crew were a lot more experimental than we actually got to see.
I would say that there was money allotted for certain angles and shots that would have given the show a bit more of a cinematic edge in certain moments. But that's what I would say.
All right.
Interesting.
Cool. Well, it's too bad we didn't get to see some of those things.
Release the LA tapes.
Yeah.
But then we see Elliot and Quentin.
Yay. Back to the mains, the real story.
The real storyline of the episode. Elliot lays down the last tile and goes, please, 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 please. But nothing happens. So
that's it. End of the episode, right?
He lays down defeated. And we start to see this is the big montage part where it's been 14 days and suddenly they have a ladder, to see the designs from up above. And we get to see some time lapses.
We see Lunk.
We see Ariel. And she says that iconic peaches and plums line. She's selling peaches and plums. She throws one at Quentin and she introduces Lunk, her helper.
Right.
Slash boyfriend.
He's kind of like Kronk. Yeah, that's who he reminds me of.
But then it's been a year.
Yes.
And it's nighttime. They're celebrating.
They're still not done.
Yep. Still not done. Still haven't solved it. And this is where Elliot and Quentin kiss for the first time.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a big moment there.
Well, it's a big moment for the fandom too, right?
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on the Quelliot?
The Quelliot of it all.
Yes.
Oh, well, I mean, I thought the seeds were planted in the novels, and I think that the show was able to expand on it to a point. I'm pretty clear about being all for it. You know, I think that there's definitely something there between those two guys. And I think it's important that they had this episode to live out a life together. And for, the queer representation side of things, I would say that it was an essential episode of the series. Actually, even outside of the queer representation of things, I think it was a beautiful episode on its own,
Yeah. My only reaction, though, is that I'm actually surprised that the episode didn't take that plot line didn't take up more of the episode, because the episode that it reminds me of the most is, I don't know if you're a Star Trek watcher, but there's a famous Picard episode where he kind of lives a life as well.
It's the entire storyline, right?
Right, yeah. Right. It's the entire storyline. So was there ever talk about that, the mosaic part of it taking up more of the storyline, or did they just have too much stuff to get through?
I think it's definitely a writer question, but I imagine that that was a pitch at some point, that it was its own episode, or it could have been. And I think that with all of the balls in the air and all of the, oh no pun, and all of the, characters, at different times over the course of the season that they have to keep track of and tie up every loose storyline, I think that this was just one that got plotted out alongside a B storyline as well. Mm-hmm. And maybe a C. I don't know if there was a C story on this episode, but it felt like it was our episode. But I remember watching it and feeling, having feelings about the fact, just having known how much we shot and how much was available, that if it had been its own episode, there would have been a lot more to showcase, even what we shot. Which is to say nothing of how the story could have developed otherwise.
Absolutely. So for those in our audience that are interested in such things, Jason Ralph, good kisser?
Jesus Christ.
He's all right.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, I've got questions. Woohoo! Speaking of Jason Ralph, what kind of background work did you guys do to create that kind of relationship and how that relationship between Elliot and Quentin changed over 50 years? Did you guys sit down and figure out a whole kind of timeline of what you guys kind of felt would happen emotionally between them and how they, you know, grew to love each other and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I remember we got together and really plotted out, you know, I think it was most important in those first years to kind of document how they grew apart and together, how you know, what their day-to-day life might have been like with their family and with the kid and raising him. And I think that there was I remember sitting down with him and really beating out the significant moments of their life together and what felt really important to look at. You know, when it jumps 50 years, you know, we didn't have the luxury of time to really sit down and say, you know, well, at year 35, this, that, and the other thing happened. But particularly for those first moments, we really wanted to be clear about how they got where they got, and then what their dynamic was as a family and what their dynamic was as a couple. So, you know, those things I think we spoke pretty openly about.
So the thing that I thought was unusual in the episode, because of the way that it was edited, and we, you know, obviously there's a time consideration, it implied that Quentin was married to Ariel, and Elliot and Quentin were a couple, but it didn't imply that it was polyamorous, I guess, mm-hmm. polyamorous relationship. Was that, do you think that that was... Was that the case when you guys were thinking about the fiction, or is that just kind of a thing that happens as a result of editing, which kind of feels like was left out?
You know, the way that it was scripted was that Quentin and Ariel were, you know, one couple, and Lunk and Elliot were a fling that I don't think lasted very long. Or maybe it wasn't Lunk. Maybe it was another, I think there was another peach seller.
Oh.
Mm.
I can't remember. It might have been Lunk. I think it was actually someone else. Like, because Lunk ends up cheating on Ariel, if I remember
right.
correctly. Yeah. And she says, he was touching someone else's plums or whatever. So there was a like Lunk 2.0, I guess, or something. I don't know if I'm remembering this correctly. So then, you know.
In the show and in the books, we've already seen Quentin and Elliot have relations together. So
yeah.
it seemed kind of odd for them to kind of
not clarify
or not lean into that. Right. I mean, considering the scene before, you guys shared a kiss.
Mm-hmm. You mean not write to it in subsequent episodes?
Well, no, just even in this episode, giving the feeling that, look, you can have this finger quote untraditional family structure of two men and a woman, you know, and them having a family together and raising a child as a group.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think part of the I think actually it was maybe intentional to keep it open-ended in that way, and to, you know, to not say too much, to let the audience fill in the blanks for themselves, and to recognize that maybe the message was that any iteration of that dynamic would have been okay.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, it, at the very least, it was a positive representation of an unusual family dynamic, which mm-hmm. that was really cool to see. How often, you know, other than, I don't know, what's another? Well, I mean, I guess there's some sitcoms that do stuff like that, right? But that have kind of like, you know, two men and a kid, or what's that show? Horrible show. it's not as good. Your one episode, I think, was better than entire six seasons or whatever of that show. All right. The other question is, what happened to Ariel?
Ariel,
sorry.
My theory is that she and Quentin got like fantasy divorced, because I think that's more fun than getting fridged, you know?
Right.
I mean, she died. I mean, I think it's clear that she dies, is what the understanding that I was always under.
Mm-hmm. Right. Choked on a peach pit, maybe.
I think some tragic, you know, illness or some
Falorian murder beast.
Probably something more like quotidian, day to day, you know, than murder beast stuff. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I think you know, it was sold as it's kind of like a family tragedy moment, right?
Mm. So they don't have a cure for tuberculosis and filari or something.
Well, there's a lot of magical drugs in the air, so it probably doesn't make it better.
Right. Yeah. What other questions do you have about, because I know this is your this is your jam.
I do. I have questions. Did you ever like decide what like Elliot thought of Ariel in just like a normal kind of way?
I think that he had nothing but love and respect for her. I mean, you know, there weren't scenes to represent that, but my understanding is that it was all, it was family, you know?
Yeah. It was all good.
Yeah.
Yes. Ugh, that's lovely. So, then we get to see, this is when like the montage really kicks in. We get to hear Evolve by Foria. Woohoo. Fun song. And we get to see, Quentin and Elliot arguing about, you know, Elliot says, if you want to live your life, live it here. What did you guys decide what they were arguing about beforehand?
Probably.
Come on, Evelyn. It was like 6 years ago.
Sorry. You know, these are the things I lay awake at night thinking about. What were they arguing about?
No, that's the things that you turn into fan fiction.
No.
What the argument was.
What the argument was.
All right. I have a question for you, Hale. How long did it take you to do your old age makeup?
Yeah. How many hours?
Oh, man. That was a nightmare day. We were in the chair at 2 a.m. and then we started shooting around 5 or 6 a.m.
Oh, my gosh.
Or maybe, no. We started shooting at 7 or 8 a.m.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was like about 6 hours.
What kind of appliances did they put on you to make you look old?
I think there was a neck piece and a nose piece and maybe three other face pieces. Mm-hmm. And then including like a wig piece, or not including a wig piece. So 5 or 6 pieces altogether. They were incredible. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. It looked great. I mean, it's amazing makeup.
Yeah.
Was there a hand double? Like who had there's that shot of the shaky hand. Was that like, did you guys,
there must have been
old guy into,
they did. They definitely painted our hands to make them look slightly older, but I imagine there was a hand double, you know.
All right.
Yeah. But then we get to see kind of the parental period. We see a baby Teddy, little Theodore Rupert Coldwaterwa. That's his full name. I love that little boy. He's so adorable.
He was very cute. Very sweet. Yeah. Sebastian, I think, is his name.
Aww.
How many scenes did you guys have with Sebastian?
You know, he was a part of this greater montage sequence, so we just improvised a bunch of stuff with him and you know, whatever made the edit. But I think there were some other moments that maybe didn't make it as well.
I know it didn't align up with what the plot was, but I thought it would have been funnier if just Teddy had solved the mosaic. Like you guys spent all these years working on it and he was like, oh, it's just this. You know?
Yeah, might have been. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, we get to see a little scene of Elliot being like just a really fun dad, and it's just great. Then Ariel, gone or dead or divorced, presumably dead.
Well, she became a pirate queen.
She became a pirate queen. She ran away. She couldn't take being a mom, so she's like, "You guys got it. Bye, deuces."
Good luck with your stupid puzzle.
And then we get to see Teddy all grown up. Now he's Tim. We love Tim in this house. Tim's great.
Tim's great.
And he's going off to like make his way in the world.
What does Tim or Teddy do? Like, what did they ever think about? Like, I mean, they never come back to the character, right?
No.
So
he's mentioned once after this.
Yeah. What is there to do for a profession in fillery?
In fillery.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think?
I don't know. Like skin and unicorns, or I don't know.
Unicorn leather probably makes some nice couches.
It's a noble profession.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then we get to see Quentin and Elliot are now older. They're in their 70s, still working on the puzzle. You know, Quentin's got this long beard.
Yeah. He looks like a dwarf.
Looks like Gandalf a little. And then Elliot dies in his sleep.
Aww.
I look like Olympia Dukakis.
Aww. See, now I thought the other thing that would happen was when Quentin wraps you up in that quilt, I thought he was going to see the mosaic puzzle on the quilt.
Well, it is. It's like mosaic.
Right. Pattern. And so all Elliot had to do was die. Well, really, it was just to wrap himself up in the quilt, and that would have made the pattern. Like, it, you know, like those Mad Magazine. Hale, do you ever read Mad Magazine? Those things on the back?
I was a big Mad Magazine kid for sure. Spy versus Spy.
Yeah, yeah. Spy versus Spy is awesome. So, you know, on the back, you would like fold the two ends together and you get like a new picture. Those Al Jaffe fold them things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I do remember that.
Maybe that was the solution. It had to be an Elliot wide fold. Put Elliot in the blanket and then fold it. Like they could have solved this like 40 years earlier if Elliot had just used that blanket to sleep in.
Well, we get to see like Quentin sleeping in it with Teddy.
That's true.
So you have a flaw in your logic.
Well, no, it's not a flaw. But anyway, and then that solves the puzzle. Ta-da!
Well, the puzzle does get solved because Quentin goes to dig Elliot's grave and finds the last tile. It's a little golden tile.
Nobody likes a puzzle when a piece is missing. And that's what this is. Is like,
no, it's an extra one. Was it? Fill up the
I think
thing.
It was that guy who walked away. No, at the beginning, he threw something. He was like, I'm fed up with this puzzle. And he throws a puzzle piece, right? A mosaic piece. Maybe it was that piece and it got over 70 years, it got buried by dirt and or like, you know, in all the day by day scuffling around, it just got covered up. And then it wasn't until Quentin is burying Elliot that he re-uncovers it.
Now, man, it's the beauty of all life. It's a life well lived.
Yeah.
Yeah. Life fully lived.
So really it's Elliot dying is the reason why the life is well lived.
I mean, he lived a whole life.
No, right. I think the life itself speaks for itself, but yeah. Maybe he needed to die for Quentin to come to that realization. Maybe. I don't know. Mm,
maybe. Who knows? I guess we'll never truly know just what exactly the beauty of all life
is. It took
is.
Quentin to appreciate life to find the mosaic tile.
Probably.
Couldn't he have just gotten that from looking at like a nice sunset or something? Did poor Elliot have to die just for this whole... Isn't there like another way to get gratification out of life? Like, isn't having a son or being married to a hot peach salesperson or something enough to qualify?
I don't know. Guess not.
I guess not.
He had to wait for his long-term best friend lover to die as well.
Okay, do you think it's a bit of a ripoff that he just has to place that one tile?
In the center?
Yeah.
But then the key comes out.
Right, but I'm saying, shouldn't he have had to rebuild the mosaic but then use that was the missing piece?
Nah.
No?
Nah.
All right.
It's just magic, man.
All right.
But yeah, he puts a tile in the center and does a little magic thing, and the key pops up.
Ta-da!
After all this time.
And then,
what a reward.
Just as he's about to use it.
Well, he doesn't know how to use it.
He doesn't know how to use it.
But we see Jane Chatwin appears. She's young.
Ta-da!
It's the 40s, apparently.
Right.
And she's like, oh, damn it, you just solved the puzzle. I was going to try and do that. And she's like, I got this watch that the dwarves made for me, but only that key can wind it because my brother is starting to get a little freaky.
So why doesn't Jane Chatwin wind the watch and then just give the key back to Elliot? I mean, to Quentin.
Elliot's dead.
Well, Elliot could use the key too. We don't know if we don't know if the key does. Maybe it would have brought Elliot back to life.
I don't know. Maybe that's another spinoff, Zombie Elliot.
There you go. How about that, Hale? You be up for a show where you're a zombie?
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
You've been in a horror movie before, correct?
Oh, mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And did you enjoy working on that horror movie?
I did enjoy it. Yeah, I really loved the director and the cast of that film. And we had a great time in Austin, Texas. So, yeah, it was a great experience.
Are we allowed to say what the horror movie is? Evelyn is
sure
making threatening motions at me. It is a movie in which you are threatened by a vagina dentata.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
Teeth.
That's the
called
one.
Teeth. That is that your one. Was that your first movie?
It was my second movie, yeah.
Second movie.
So pretty close.
Did that fulfill any childhood dreams for you?
Yeah, pretty much all of them.
Oh, God. Great. Wonderful. Quentin gives Jane the key.
I've embarrassed Evelyn.
And then we see Margot opening her wedding gifts, and she says to Prince Velmar, I got to open all these gifts before we can consummate our marriage or else your dick will fall off.
She should have just said, oh, look, here's my wedding gift. Pa-dang, throw a knife into his head.
Well, she didn't think of that.
Yep.
You know, But she gets a letter from Quentin along with like some peaches and plums, and it says, "Hey, you know, here's the illusion key. We took the quest as far as we could, but Elliot and I both died.
We're dead if you're reading this.
But we lived a really full and happy life."
Why didn't Quentin march over to Whitespire?
Because it was
70 years.
They still weren't there.
Well, then he could have hung out with the Chatwins and like the centaurs and relived the adventures of he could have been the fifth or eighth or whatever character in the book.
He's already in the book.
Twice.
He's in the book twice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But poor Elliot is not mentioned at all in the books.
Nope.
That's a bummer. Hey, Hale, do you think Lev will ever write the actual books?
I don't know. I don't think that I would know that. I think you'd have to ask Lev. I mean, I...
All right, let me rephrase that. Would you want Lev to write the books?
The Fillory and Further books?
Yeah.
I don't think he needs to. But if he feels he needs to, then he does. You know, it's right. I think Lev probably has a lot of books in him, you know? Right. So
right now they're about trains. They're not about Fillory.
The train books are good.
I have not read it yet. Don't spoil it for me. I thought he had
a King Arthur book or something.
Still in progress.
Yeah, he's working on a King Arthur book.
Lev has some
really serious fish to fry.
Right. He's got a lot of fandoms he needs to service.
Well, maybe we'll get a Fillory and Further book.
Maybe.
I mean, or you can just write one.
No, I don't write fan fiction. that's a running joke on this show, Hale.
Okay.
I'm always coming up with great ideas for fan fiction, and then Evelyn says, "You should write that." And I say, "No, I don't write fan fiction."
You don't need to explain it.
Well, I know. But Hale doesn't know. I'm assuming Hale doesn't listen to this podcast.
Well, now is being
that's okay. You don't have to answer that. You don't need to incriminate yourself.
But then we see Margo goes to the Clock Barons where Jane Chatwin is. She's still alive, kind of outside of time. And Margo demands to have the time key back. She's like, "Both my best friends are dead. And I've had a really shitty couple of days. And sometimes it feels like I'm just the Fillorian middle manager. I don't really, you know, Quentin and Elliot are the ones calling the shots and I'm just over here." But Jane says, you know, you'll get your turn and your tale is your own. Go dig up my corpse.
Right. And she says that, she's in that Margo or that Jane has created this time loop that she exists outside of time.
That.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Hey, Hale, do you know what the worst thing about being stuck in a time loop is?
I hate you so much.
Like the same meal. I don't know.
Hey, Hale, do you know what the worst thing about being stuck in a time loop is?
Two is enough.
I don't know. What is it? Got it. Really fell for that one.
Well, we come back and Elliot and Quentin are alive again. They're about to go through the clock. And Margo comes in. She says, "You bitches looking for these?" She's got both the keys. They've disappeared from their hands. And we see Elliot and Margo have a big old hug, and it's just so sweet. We get this tender best friend reunion. And then they're just like eating snacks, chatting, and Quentin's like, "Wow, we died."
As you do.
Crazy.
So if Margo created a time loop to...
She didn't.
She did, because she stopped Elliot and Quentin from experiencing that time sequence, although it does exist.
It does exist.
I know, but it exists in a Back to the Future-esque parallel universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does Jane ever get the key?
Clearly, yes.
No, clearly no.
Well, she...
Because
she
they don't ever get the key from the mosaic.
It's self-sustaining. It's like a tree.
So is
and
it,
they're the roots.
Now that the key is out in the universe... That event happened.
It's self-fulfilling because it has to happen for everything else in the show to happen.
Well, yeah, but...
Yeah. Don't make a face.
Okay.
But yeah, just chilling, eating snacks, talking about your deaths, you know?
What kind of snacks were those?
I don't know. What kind of snacks were those?
Hell, what kind of snacks did you guys eat the most on the set of The Magicians 6 years ago?
I think it depended on the day, probably. A lot of, I don't know, God, a lot of chips.
A lot of chips. As a working actor, what was your favorite types of chips to eat on set?
What does that have to do with being
chips. I just made up chips, and I can't think of a chip brand off the top of my head. No,
you don't need to. You don't need. Although you could have our commercial for today chips.
Is
Lay's actually? Didn't we do Lay's potato chips some other time?
We don't need a commercial for that.
We have a running gag, Hale, where we
You don't need to explain every gag we have on this podcast. Our commercial for today is the Santa Barbara Zoo. Go to it. There's gorillas. It's great.
And you can get excellent zoo fudge there.
Don't stop.
Sounds delicious.
It actually is quite good. All right, there you go. Zoo Fudge. That's our sponsor.
We did our sponsor.
We're trying desperately to get sponsorship, and it just hasn't worked for us yet. So we have to make up our own sponsors.
Well, then we see Alice and Julia. They're having a drink. And Alice says, you know, I could use some magic, and you've got magic, but you don't know where this magic is coming from. Maybe you can use a mirror to focus it and figure it out. So Julia takes out the truth key and looks into a mirror and sees Reynard's eyes in her own.
Yeah, jump scare.
And like the scene changes and suddenly we see Our Lady Underground. She's sitting at a table. She invites Julia to come and sit with her and says that she planted a seed inside Julia of power that came from Reynard, but now it's hers to use.
Right. Freeing her of the responsibility of feeling guilty about Reynard.
And Julia says that, you know, gods have a very loose concept of what consent is. But Olya says, you know, it's yours now and you get to choose what you do with it. And Alice says the same thing when Julia comes back. But Alice has the idea, why doesn't Julia give her magic and then, you know, do a little transplant kind of thing, which we'll see if that's successful or not.
Right. To be continued.
To be continued. And then we see Katie. She tries to check out. Not very successful because, you know, she was caught on camera yelling to nothing.
Doesn't make her look very sane.
And then she tries to run away, which doesn't really help her case for sanity as well.
Poor Katie.
Poor Katie. But then it's the final scene. Margot takes Elliot and Quentin to the Whitespire's throne room, and she leaves to go kind of hide from Fomar for a bit. He's passed out on the bed. And Quentin finds his own letter that he sent to Margot, and, you know, Elliot takes a little peach from the little basket they've got, and Quentin starts reading the letter, and Elliot, you know, smells the peach, and you get this kind of sense memory that their memories get triggered.
Right.
The music starts playing again, and
it was real after all.
It was real after all. You know, Elliot, you take a huge bite out of that peach, man. It's a big bite.
Yeah, he was hungry.
How many peaches did you have to eat in that scene?
Oh boy.
I think maybe like we got it in a few takes. I remember we did like two or three of those takes in it. It was good. So yeah, like three takes over two or three setups. So probably nine peaches.
And are you a
you peach fan?
Are you a peach fan?
I am a peach fan, yes.
Ah. There we go. We've learned something new.
We learn something new every day. But they start getting their memories back. And, you know, Elliot says, oh my God, I got so old. And then this is where, like, before, you know, they were joking about how they died. And like, wow, that's crazy. But now it's like, oh my God, you died.
Right.
I died. And, you know, Elliot says, you know, Quentin, you had a wife and we had a family. How do we remember this? And, you know, that's we cut with them, you know, looking confused and kind of sad. And
right, well, just, on one hand, happy that they had this relationship, but sad that that's not
just,
the
whole
reality
mess
they're
of
in.
Confliction,
right?
You know, and I do so. Hale, I was wondering, like, how did Elliot feel after realizing and remembering that he lived this long life after for like. So long throughout the show, you know, Elliot talks about how he expects to die early in life and how he doesn't really anticipate living past, you know, maybe 30. And now he has kind of this proof, though, you know, he kind of mentally denies it, that he like lived this long life, this, and, you know, lived to such an old age and was actually happy and had this fulfilling queer relationship and became like a good father. And that, like, what was that like emotion that you kind of thought about?
You know, I think that he really surprised himself with what was possible. And mm-hmm. I think this episode proves to him that he's not as stone-hearted as he likes to advertise. I mean, I think we all know Elliot has a pure heart at the end of the day, but it's not something that he's comfortable always expressing. So this was really a turning point for him, even though in subsequent episodes he's not as willing or able to look that truth in the eye, which I would probably relegate to the years of trauma that he faced as a, you know, as a child of certain kinds of verbal abuse and whatever. You know, the family dynamic was super hard on him. And so the need, the necessity for him to create the persona in the first place stems from all of that trauma. So I think that that's not something that just goes away, even though, you know, you have a really beautiful moments, or in this case, a really beautiful life. I mean, by all accounts, it should completely transform him. And I think that there might have been a different way to tell that story. But I'm grateful that this episode exists altogether, and that, you know, they were able to provide these characters with that experience.
Was there ever a moment, like moving forward in the other seasons, where the knowledge of Elliot having that whole life informed a way that you portrayed something, you know, either in the latter half of season three or moving into the other seasons?
Yes. I think that, you know, kind of as a rule, I always felt the need to take the lived experience of the character from episode to episode along for the journey. Even though sometimes episodes can feel quite episodic, in the sense that we reset the clock and reset the timer, and here we are on a whole new adventure and a whole new episode, and, you know, everything that happened in the previous episode is easily forgotten or swept under the rug. For me, I think what kept Elliot interesting for me was to keep a tally of everything that had happened, you know, and to keep that memory alive for him, so that there's an accumulation of events and story that tracks over the course of the show.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, so Hale, do you have any last thoughts for us about maybe this episode in particular, or something about your experience, you know, working on The Magicians that you'd like to share with us?
You know, not much other than, you know, I think the fandom is really beautiful and has provided a comfort to each other through challenging times. And that's really given me something to celebrate and to be proud of as well. So that's really, you know, the message that I would just want to reiterate out there for all you guys who are listening.
Aww. Thank you.
Speaking of the fandom, Evelyn, what is going on in the fandom of The Magicians right now?
So when this episode comes out on Saturday, April 17th, there will be the GalaxyCon Magicians Experience, where you can talk to Hale.
Oh,
And also Summer Bishel, Harvey Gillian, Stella Maeve, Olivia Taylor Dudley, Brittany Curran, Jade Taylor, and I think that's everyone. I'm doing this off the top of my head.
Will this be out before that event?
It will be on the Friday, right
before. Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay. Oops, sorry. well, maybe this is worth mentioning. I'll be donating a significant amount of the proceeds of that con to For the Gwarls, which is a Black trans run organization for trans people.
So excellent.
If you're on the fence about participating, or, you know, want your money to go to a good place, know that at least for my signings and meetups, autographs, etc., a significant portion will be donated. So if that is, you know, if that suits your fancy.
That's wonderful. Ugh, that's great. And you can still donate to IO's charity, I believe, right, Hale?
I think IO's charity has sort of been, at this point, you know, IO is directing everyone to the charity I just mentioned, for the Gworls, GWORLS. You can find them on Instagram if you want to make a donation yourself. So yeah, I think Self-Evident is not seeing the same kind of activity as it was in terms of donations, and IO's got 7 other projects. So yeah, definitely.
Busy.
He's very busy.
He's a busy guy.
But yeah, there's also the Stonefruit Grimoire, which is the fandom spellbook, which is a Google Doc where you can add spells for the magicians that you've come up for yourself that you've used in stories that you've written. So that's a Google Doc that you can find at Sylphiel on Twitter. I also posted it because I got commissioned to do the book cover for that. And also the Magician's Big Bang is still happening. People are posting previews of their stories, and very soon the artist's kind of bid will be happening. So people will be paired, artists and writers. So that'll be super cool. But other than that, that's all.
Awesome. And Hale.
So we have to rate the episode.
Oh, remember we have to rate. Oh, rating the episode.
So we have a rating system where we rate this season out of 7 keys.
Right.
So would you like to go first or last?
Out of 7 keys, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think this is like a 7 key episode for the fans, right? So if I feel like if I say anything else, I'll be breaking hearts and ruining legacies. But I think this is one of the highlights of my experience on the show for sure. So I would give it a 7.
Aw, wonderful.
All right, I have to go next.
You're gonna go next?
I'll go next. Yeah. Okay. Because everybody wants the, well, they already know what you're gonna rate it, right?
Yes, it's a 7 out of 7 for me. This is one of my favorite episodes. Not my number one. I know you thought this was my number
one. Yeah, I thought this was your number one episode.
It's not my number one episode.
All right.
But it is definitely up there, like top 3.
Right.
And I just love seeing this is the quality episode for me, man. I completely forget all the other plot lines whenever I watch it. But I just love seeing them go through, the kind of emotions and the life that they lived, you know, made a little zine about it and everything.
And you always get a little misty eyed at the end.
Yeah.
All right. So my rating. So I have to consider all the elements that are in it.
Oh my God.
And there is, let's see, what do we have in here? We've got some penny drama, and we've got some puzzling, and we've got some magical spotlights, and we've got eyeballs rolling up and becoming white. And so I guess, oh, and Lunk. So I guess we'll have to give this a 7 out of 7.
Woo-hoo.
I would agree. I think that now we've talked about this before. I don't think that there's an episode of The Magicians other than the pilot where you can say, you know, this is the Hush episode, or this is the, what's the Doctor Who one with the statues that come after you?
Weeping Angels.
The Weeping Angels episode. Right. But I'd say this is close. And if this episode had just been all about Elliot and Quentin doing the mosaic, I probably would say this is the episode you should watch, because I think that the relationship and the story is so sweet. And this is really the aberrant episode because only one person gets killed, but it's Micah, so it's no big loss. but for the most part, yeah, the acting, Hale, you do such a wonderful job in this episode. Jason does a wonderful job. Summer does a wonderful job. Everybody is just really on point on this one. And the story moves forward. And in the past, I've kind of complained about storylines that deviate from the books, the things that the writers have to make up to kind of like, you know, fill in the in-between gaps. But I think out of all of them, this is the most worthy and the most Lev worthy, I think, of the all the storylines that they came up with.
Yeah. But yeah, so hey, where can people find you?
Where can find me?
Yeah.
You can find me at Mighty Bedbug on Twitter and on Instagram. Where can they find you?
You can find me at wow_then on Twitter and at fishydoros on Instagram and Patreon, also under the name Evelyn Rogers. Hale, where can people find you?
Oh, wherever Hales are found, I guess. I have an Instagram, HaleBoFoShow, and a Twitter, Hale_Appleman, and that's what I got. I don't TikTok.
You don't TikTok?
You don't TikTok?
We have a really good TikTok for this.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We have a TikTok. It's Fillory and Father, and we have a Gmail, Fillory and Father, where you can send us emails, and a Twitter, Fillory Father. Send us stuff, please.
Yes, we love getting emails, although we haven't gotten any yet.
No emails.
One day we'll get email.
One day we'll get emails.
Well,
but Hale, you know, people can find you on Truth Be Told Season 2.
Yep.
Correct.
Anywhere else. I know you're doing an album, but it's, you know, we're just patient, man.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, one of these lifetimes.
Uh-huh. Any other exciting projects coming your way?
Hopefully. That's the idea. We'll see what happens. Mm. It's a bit of an audition right now.
Yeah. Oh, great. Well, good luck with that. I'm sure break a leg. I'm sure you'll kill it.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being on our show.
This has been a real pleasure and a real honor, and and all hail the High King. we loved having you, Hale. It was so great to talk to you and let us know all of our dumb questions and good ones about this episode.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day, guys.
Yeah. Hooray. Yay, we did it. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.